We'll rise into the rain report for October 9th, 2009 in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. From the Radio Amateur Information Network, this is the Rain Report, available for transmission via amateur radio from therainreport.com. I'm Dwayne Whittingham, N9SSN. If you know someone who had dabbled in amateur radio ballooning, chances are that person was mentored by Huntsville, Alabama's Ham Bill Brown, WB8ELK, considered by his peers as the father of ham radio ballooning. While his expertise in rocket and spatial technology are special, his ham radio roots were not.
I first got into ham radio because my great uncle, W8UN, was a ham radio operator since 1923. And when I was a kid, I would go over to his house and I'd marvel at him talking to people all over the world. Of course, back then, there were racks full of tube equipment and monster radios, so it was all very impressive for a 4- and 5-year-old boy watching all this with marvel. And the thing that really impressed me, the beeps from Sputnik. He was receiving the very first satellite from space. And when he told me that was in space, flying over northwest Ohio, going beep, 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 that hooked me right there.
The year was?
58. I was 5 years old. As I got older, I finally got my ham ticket in 1969, just 2 days after the moon landing.
Why did you wait until 1969 to get your ham ticket?
Well, that's a good question. I was into a whole bunch of things, including model rocketry. I used to make my own rocket engines. There was a book called The Rocket Boys, which got turned into the movie October Sky, and many of that was some of what I did. I was into chemistry and rockets, and I'd build my own rockets, and I'd blow up my own rockets in the backyard. So I had just a wide variety of interests. Electronics and experimenting with electronics is what finally got me into ham radio. My uncle was an influence, but took it till I was about 14 or 15 before I really got inspired to do electronics, and that was from reading Popular Electronics and Popular Mechanics and Radio Electronics magazine. When I finally figured out that it was really fun to learn how to tear things apart and how to recreate them. I don't know if you remember what a Fahnestock clip is. It was this little clip that you could put wires together with, and you could make a breadboard. I built a Morse code one-tube transmitter when I first got my ham radio license, and I had a TV transformer powering that thing. Those clips, it was just a rat's nest of wires. Those clips actually shorted out, causing a spectacular arcing and zapping, and knocked the fuse out in the garage, and it's really a wonder that I'm here today after all that, between learning how to make my own fireworks and blowing things up in the barnyard and shorting things out through electronics. I somehow survived to today.
So you got your novice in 1969.
1969, and I loved Morse code. That was my favorite mode of operation.
So you were 16 years of age then.
Yes.
What was your first ham rig?
I was a Johnson Viking 2, and I had a Hallicrafters SX-101A. It was at Dayton Hamvention. The thing must have weighed 50 or 60 pounds, and I had to park way, way from the main arena. And I was so determined to buy that radio, and I couldn't find anyone else to help me carry it. They were all off in some part of the Hamvention. I literally carried that 50-pound radio for probably a quarter of a mile to my car, but I was so thrilled to get such a beautiful radio.
How old were you at your first Hamvention?
So my first Hamvention was actually when I was 15, about a year before I got my ham license. I was really starting to get into it at that point. I bought the whole station in 1969, a few months before I got my license.
You actually drove yourself to the Hamvention?
No, my dad and I went down, and he had just gotten his ham license as well. At the time, though, we had to drive all the way to Detroit, Michigan, and go to the FCC exam office.
You were living where?
Findlay, Ohio. The guy was kind of mean and very strict and very intimidating, and we were taking the exam. Now, my dad was a radio operator in World War II. He could copy perfect Morse code at 35 words a minute. So he figured that part of the exam would be duck soup for him. But the guy failed him. And Dad said, well, that's perfect copy. What are you talking about? Well, my dad draws his J's without a bar across the top.
Oh.
And the examiner says, those aren't J's, those are U's.
Oh, no.
And he would not let him go with that. It was because Dad didn't do proper handwriting. He failed him on handwriting, not the ability to copy Morse code. That's how mean the guy was.
So how did he resolve that?
He went back a month or two later and he had to retake the test, and it was like a 120-mile drive to go up there.
Now, in those years, you had to wait a certain period of time.
At least a month, I believe, maybe more than that. But he eventually did go back, and he made sure to cross his J's.
So you got your Johnson Viking. That was your first transmitter and your Hallett-Crafter 101, right. First receiver. What do you remember about your first contact?
My first contact was a fellow in Illinois on 40 meters. I was thrilled to death to hear my call sign come back on Morse code. That was the ultimate to me, to actually make that first two-way contact, because for several years prior, actually it's been several years, I had been listening with a little, it was just an, I forget the name of it, but it was a little radio that had a linear dial. And it had horrible Morse code capability on it. It sounded like Morse code was not a pure tone, let's say that. But I was able to copy Morse code up to about 30 words a minute about 2 years before I actually got my license. My uncle and a good friend of his would talk to each other on Morse code from Ohio to Florida, and I would listen in. And no one could copy his friend in Florida, because he would go 30 words a minute, would never slow down for anyone. I would copy a word or two here and there, a letter or two. I always could copy my uncle because he'd go about 18, 20 words a minute. But finally, one day, I was sick for about 3 days, and I listened in on their daily schedule, and I tried and tried and tried to copy the 30 words a minute from this guy, and one day it just clicked, and I was able to do it. That was a real thrill to me.
You're listening to the story behind amateur radio balloon specialist Bill Brown, WB8ELK, as related to Rain's Hap Holly KC9RP. Bill will resume his story, or should I say stories, in a moment. This is the Rain Report, available via terrestrial dial-up at 773-358-7845, thanks to Uttle Systems. That's 773-358-7845. 7845. We'll be right back. This is the Radio Amateur Information Network, www.therainreport.com.
So CW, Morse code, was your preferred mode of operation to start with. Where did it go from there?
I went all the way from Morse code to fast-scan amateur television. Shortly after I got my ham license, I discovered that there were people in the area that had their own private TV stations, and they could all operate it on amateur radio. And that thrilled me to no end, because as kids, our big old monster TV was on the fritz at the repair shop more often than it was working. So my sister and I would take turns inside the TV housing, which was this monster chassis, pretending like we were on TV. I got an old TV camera, an old Dage tube camera, and a blonder tongue UHF down converter, and found that you could tweak them to cover the 70 centimeter ham band. I put an antenna up on the roof, home-built antenna on 439 megahertz, actually 439.25, and sure enough, I could watch these fellows sending video to each other from across town, and one guy was 20 miles away.
This was 1969?
Right.
How did you learn about amateur TV back then?
I went to my local radio club, where my uncle was an officer, and he took me to one of the radio club meetings after I was starting to get taken interest. They gave a presentation at the club meeting about amateur TV. That hooked me right there as a teenager. I said, that is where I want to go. And slow scan television, I'd hear these funny sounds on HF bands, and I wanted to know what all that was about, so I built one of the very first slow scan kits. It was a monster kit, too, but did that about a year or two after getting my ham license.
Who manufactured the kit?
Called the VideoScan 1000. I don't remember the manufacturer.
Did you have a job at that time that you could actually...
Yes, I actually, as you know, I've been involved with amateur radio publications of one sort or another over the years. My very first job in high school was working at the local newspaper. The editor of our local newspaper had started a ham radio publication called Radio Trade Around. We would go to the ham fest around the Midwest, and it was a buy-sell flea market publication, but his idea was to add some articles about amateur radios. I was their first reporter. I would run around interviewing people about amateur radio and do stories about them. It was a great summer job. I did that for a couple of years.
This is while you were in high school.
Yeah, I was in high school. That was my very first foray into the world of amateur radio publication.
Did he pay you for the article? Or
I got a whopping salary of about $1.15 an hour as a reporter salary, which beat the $1 an hour I got at the Dog and Suds hamburger place. I didn't like that job.
Now we enter the 70s, and you're involved in ATV. Where did it go from there?
From there, I got more and more involved in ATV. I went to college at Ohio State and got involved with the amateur radio station at Ohio State, which is W8LT. I lived at the stadium dorm there, and the radio station for the club station was in one of the towers of the football stadium at Ohio State. And they had all kinds of great equipment, marvelous station. And I would talk to my father 100 miles away. I had a weekly schedule with him on like a Tuesday night and on 80 meters. And one night I was talking to him. We had this monster amplifier. It was an Army amplifier, 600 watts, a BC610.
Oh my gosh.
That thing is a monster. You turn it on, the lights dim, you can hear the generators go. It probably caused a brownout in several city blocks when you turn the thing on. And it produced enough heat that you didn't need a floor heater inside the shack because it would keep you nice and toasty warm. And the glow from the tube was enough to light the ham shack to boot. But I sometimes had to turn that on when our conversation took a little fade. It was a monster long wire. It was a 600-foot long wire, 120 feet off the ground between
wow.
the tower of the football stadium and the smokestack of the power station across the quad from
600
us.
600 feet.
That was great. Wonderful, wonderful little station. Well, one day, I'm talking to my father in Findlay, Ohio, and I'm down in Columbus, Ohio, University, Iowa State Radio Club. I get this phone call on their phone. I pick it up, and it says, "Is this the amateur radio station?" "Yes." "Did you just transmit?" I said, "Yes, I did." "Can you transmit again?" So I did. He said, "It's you. It's you. I finally found it." I said, "Well, who is this?" He said, "This is Professor So-and-so at the physics department. You are heating up my absolute zero experiment by 4 degrees whenever you transmit." And he said, "I can see TV and radio stations turn on and off their high power at night, and they affect me by about a half a degree. But whenever you transmit, wham, 4 degrees. I was a mile away from that. But apparently his chamber for getting down to that temperature was fairly resonant on 80 meters. And then I put up an amateur television antenna on top of the tower there at the football stadium. And I got to tell you, even though our antenna tower itself is 25 feet tall, the base of the tower was 100 feet above the ground. And when you're up there trying to work, even though you're 25 feet above the concrete, one side of it you look down, it's 125 feet, and it's pretty unnerving.
That must have gotten out really well.
It did. It really, really worked well. I was working Bill Parker, W8DMR, who lives in Columbus, Ohio, and he's an amazing antenna designer and experimenter, as well as amateur television enthusiast and pioneer. And we would hold schedules from Ohio State's club station, and he'd clear across town. And he really got me more and more hooked onto experimentation, amateur television, and antenna design. I have to say he was quite an inspiration when I lived in Columbus.
What degree did you earn there and in what year?
Biochemistry, 75.
From there you headed out to California.
Yes, went to UC Santa Barbara, University of California, which I actually called UC Surfing Branch, completely surrounded by a beach. We had a really wonderful club station there. That's the one thing. When I was going to college and even in high school, I had friends in town my age with Heathkit lunch boxes. They were relatively cheap, 2-meter units, tunable. We would talk to each other. This is what us high school kids did instead of having a cell phone to text to each other. We used the lunch box as our own private communication. That really was an inspiration to get more and more involved in amateur radio. I don't see that as much anymore, particularly at the high school level. There are very few radio club stations in high school, and even the college stations are getting less and less participants. You just need to find ways of bringing the younger people into exciting. I think these digital modes, which is what we're discussing here at the Digital Communications Conference, I think these new digital modes and the ability to do texting using amateur radio on both ends, which Bob Runninga talked about, I believe that's one of the ways we can bring in younger people into and get them excited about the hobby once again.
So in 1975, you headed out to sunny Southern California, yes, where your master's work?
Yes, I did. I actually did a master's in chemistry, and I worked for a year in Los Angeles, in the smoggiest part of Los Angeles, at a label company. I was an analytical chemist for the sticky side of a label, and I'll tell you, the fumes from the adhesives that they used, combined with the smog, really got to me. Mm. One day, the custodian who swept up the sidewalk came to me and says, "Bill, there's this black powder that shows up on my sidewalk every morning, and I have to sweep it up. The whole sidewalk is black." And he handed me a vial of black powder. He says, "Can you analyze this?" So I took it in and ran it through all my analysis equipment, and I just about keeled over laughing. Keep in mind that we're one block from the 210 freeway through Pasadena, and a million cars a day drive down that freeway.
So just what was that black powder Bill analyzed those many years ago? You'll have to wait until next week to find out. And with that, we'll conclude part one of Hap Holly, KC9RP's interview with Bill Brown, WB8ELK, considered the father of amateur radio ballooning, a subject Bill covered thoroughly during his banquet talk at the 28th Annual Tapper ARRL Digital Communications Conference last month in suburban Chicago. Hap will return with Bill next week to delve into Bill's introduction to ballooning. The Rain Report is a weekly production of the Radio Amateur Information Network. Copyright 1990 through 2009 Rain. All rights are reserved. Now, for all those connected with the Rain Report, I'm Dwayne Whittingham, N9SSN. This is Rain, www.therainreport.com.